Betterworth's downloadable weekly podcast program. The guest this week, he's the April O'Neil of the Merton Magistrates Court. It's Ben Clover. Welcome to Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable week with me, Ollie Bettesworth. I hope you've had a great week and a bit since the last episode. In fact, it's been 2 weeks now. I do apologise for that. There was no episode last week, but that's probably a mixture between technical difficulties, trying to get the parts to record to my new laptop, and the recording schedule. You know, if guests aren't available, then, you know, I can't do the show. It's not my fault. It's not poor. It's certainly not poor planning. What makes it worse is there's not going to be an episode next week either, I'm afraid. But to make up for it, the episode that will come within the next 2 weeks is going to be with Callie Beaton. And she's been on QI and everything. So, you know, quick plug to get it out of the way. My Brighton Fringe show is coming up. It's looming. And it's May 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th. The venue is called Sweet at the Welly. That's Sweet Venues at the Wellington Pub on Gloucester Road in Brighton. 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th. It's called Ollie Bettesworth, Le Fou Roux. Ollie Bettesworth, Le Fou Roux. And it is at 5:40 p.m. I have to repeat the title because it is so unbearably pretentious that most of you won't get it. I just skillfully undercut my pretension with a well-placed burp. I hope you appreciated that. It is about Vincent van Gogh, and it's called Le Fou Roux. It is an hour of untested material in a format of show that I've never done before. But it will be funny. I believe it will, anyway. It's free, though, so what's to lose, really, other than your time and respect for me? My guest this week is the very funny Ben Clover, who, as well as being a terrific comedian, is also a journalist, and he used to exclusively cover the borough of Merton, which fans of the show will know is where the podcast is recorded, in lovely, sunny Mitcham. So fans of the show and fans of Mitcham, Mitcham heads, are in for a treat because we talk quite a lot about his experiences and his stories being a reporter in the area. Gives it a nice little geographical context. Just a bit of a disclaimer before we start. I am getting a little bit paranoid, and I have been over the last few weeks as the episodes have come out, because I am consistently louder than my guests are in the mix. And I can hear you at home. I can hear what you're saying. You're saying that Ollie Bettesworth is an amazing podcast host. The format is revolutionary, and I love him like a brother, but a brother I'd like to bang, because he is sexy AF. But I will say this, he is consistently louder in the mix, and it's because he's putting his mic up louder due to the fact that he is an egomaniac. Well, that is very far from the truth. I spend quite a lot of time before each episode trying to make my guests louder, and I will not be criticised or held to account for my superior mic technique. Okay? That is the last that's going to be said about it. Now, please do enjoy Series 3, Episode 4 of Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast programme, on which my guest Ben Clover and I discuss trousers, warlords, babies, and affluenza. Enjoy. Ben Clover is here. How are you?
I'm good. I thrive.
Let's pretend that we haven't just been talking for an hour and that you've just walked through my front door and you've sat down.
God, it's cold. It's raining out there.
What did you think of the hallway outside? Pretty terrifying?
Yeah. It was like the corridor in The Shining, but less homely somehow. Like the kid could be riding a really big bike. It could have been two haunted kids on a tandem.
It's quite apt that the siren was playing the entire way through that description. Just to
the refrain of the law heard at a distance. It's like something Victor Hugo would bang on about. But yeah, they didn't have sirens back then. I've often thought that with a song, you know, a song that goes whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. It's like, in most countries, that's not the sound of the police.
No.
It's like, it's not here. Like, it must have been really confusing for that rapper as he went around the world, well, for his audiences going, whoop, whoop. And people are like, no, hear the siren of the police. He's like, you know. But he can't alternate it for everyone. Anyway.
No, that would be impractical.
For the end of tour party, you'd be like, we're going to go around the world in sirens. You know, probably only Ross Kemp could tell you what they all were, because he's done, you know, Ross Kemp on gangs in every postcode, in every town, in every favela. I don't know how you say
that's
it.
That's his entire life now.
That's what he does.
He's been undercover for the last 18 years. going undercover in every single gang.
In the world. He probably did the Mitcham gangs. Back when I was a reporter around here, there was like, there was one Mitcham gang that was called Terror Zone, TZ for short. I think they were just teenagers. I don't think they were like a proper gang with a sort of kingpin, but there were stabbings.
You were saying before we started recording that the last time you were here in Mitcham in Fountain House or on this estate.
I think it was Fountain House. I think it was
this, the one I live in, great.
It might even have been this floor, I don't remember. But
what was the circumstance?
It was for a police raid.
Terrific.
I was accompanying the police on a police raid.
In what context?
So I was the local reporter.
Oh, not the police chief.
I wasn't in the police. No. Like, do you want to come do work experience on the police? Like, yeah, all right. In what role? You're going to be police chief, unpaid for 2 weeks.
It's a new initiative.
It'll be good on your CV. You'd be like, yeah, I had to do disciplinary, internal stuff, had to plan strategy. No, it was with the cops. And they seemed like quite a happy family unit.
You were a journalist.
I was a journalist, yeah.
Covering the story of the police raid.
Yeah, they wanted to show that they were like tough on drugs on like the first floor of this building.
So what did they find?
Crack cocaine. I wish I could remember the name of the operation.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Is it still quite... This was more than 10 years ago that I did this, so is it still quite crack-ridden around here?
I wouldn't know, actually. That's not fair. It's still not very nice, but I wouldn't say it was crack-ridden.
Fair enough. I'm speaking to drug workers in the borough, and
I would
it's
say
not as bad as Hackbridge.
It dabbles in crack.
Gotcha. Kind of like bank holidays.
Yeah, special occasions, birthdays,
kind of,
Christmas.
But not a habitual...
Shrove Tuesday.
That sounds about right. I mean, so maybe it works. You know, kind of conventional drugs policy and policing of drugs gets a bad rap, but maybe they cracked it.
Maybe it was your story.
Bloody hell, yeah, because...
It transformed the area.
They went, do you want to get a picture of
Thanks,
him?
Thanks, man.
And then they dragged him out, like the guy,
and
I took a picture of him on my little handheld camera because the photographer from the paper didn't want to get up that early to come on the raid.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put it in the paper. In the local paper.
Great. Well, I'm glad that you're here under slightly more positive circumstances.
Only slightly.
Before we go on, because I want to pick up your journalism in this, because you were a journalist, but also specifically in this area, Mitcham.
Yeah, covering Mitcham.
Because I went to go and see a show you did on this very subject in Edinburgh, which is very good. Lots of fun. But before we continue, I just want to get it out the way that one of the things that I'm quite proud of on this podcast is that I have just a terrific velvety sort of radio voice that just sort of just lightly massages the listeners' ears as they're on the way to work.
Christ.
And it's just sort of my trademark. But on this podcast, I feel as though I've sort of met my match.
Oh,
because
guys.
You have a remarkably calming radio voice. And I'm...
Well, I don't really know what to say, but I guess what I say is not the point.
With you and Sunil Patel, I've had a run of very kind of relaxed, laid back, hey guys, let's just lower ourselves into a nice warm bath.
Ah, and
type
just
podcasts.
Open up those veins
and
off we drift. But I think Sunil's genuinely relaxed, whereas my tragedy is I have a relaxing tone, but inside...
Are you not relaxed?
Terrible tumult.
Really?
Tumult, 24/7 tumult. I'm okay.
What causes your tumult?
I think see it, say it, sort it. I just, I can't stand having...
See it, say it, sort it.
Have you not heard see it, say it, sort it?
I've never heard anyone say that before.
Have you not been on public transport?
See it, say it, sort it.
Yeah, there's a public announcement on every single train and tube saying beware of danger.
Oh.
And if you see an unattended package, see it, say it, sort it. And it's...
I've got to sort it out.
No, they'll sort it.
Oh, okay.
But it is confusing because it's like you have to say it. Well, it would be weird if you were going to sort it out, but you had to, and you have to see it first. I get it.
So you see it, you say, there is a bomb.
Yeah.
And then go about disarming it.
You go about disarming it, but actually what they want is for them to sort it. But so you're still doing 2/3 of the work.
Okay.
But they say it on every public transport journey I take. Like, I hear it maybe twice.
And I've never heard it.
Have you? This...
It may be just in your head.
Yeah, so it's a further source of worry, just not one. It's like the end of some slightly crappy 2000 AD story, where it's like, no, it's actually you're mad, you know. I remember one really good one where it was like this weird clown kills loads of people in a market town, and eventually the police grab him. And they say, what have you done it, you evil clown? And he was like, because nothing's pointless, we're just characters in a cartoon strip. And the cops are like... No, we're not.
Whoa.
And then the clown says, well, if we're not, who's that breathing? And he points at you. And then the policeman looks at you and goes, oh, my God, he's right. Please don't turn the page. Don't turn the page. And because I was such a soppy kid for ages, I'd leave the magazine open on that page.
Oh.
But eventually, he's not real. I can't. But I still felt a slight duty towards this imaginary copper. Yeah, how do we get on to that? Oh, yeah, me being mad. No, they say see it, say it, sort it all the time. And... it drives me nuts. But one nice thing.
So you get paranoid, or what's stressing you out about it?
I think. Just
why is it not safely ignored?
Having, because you can ignore it, but it's just kind of being made aware of the possibility of violent death 4 times a day, on top of all the other times that my mind wanders to the possibility of violent death on the tube anyway, is too much. If it just went, you'll probably be fine. You know, if for every see it, say it, sort it, or every 10, you had to throw in one kind of like...
But don't worry.
Be lucky, you know, something chipper, you know, that would be nice. Because they've got this forum. I mean, one thing that is nice about it, right, is that you hear different station staff do it at each place. And it's a bit like a jazz standard. You know, it's a bit like when the Saints go marching in. Like, the tune's the same.
Oh, they have the different versions.
But they have their different intonations. You know?
Oh, okay.
So some people seem to say it, sort it, implying that you should sort it. And other people say it, sorted.
Sorted.
We'll sort it.
Oh, I see.
But either way, I'd rather have my arms blown off by a terrorist than ever have to hear it again. Cat's on the mixing desk.
The cat, for about the last 5 minutes, has been doing everything it can possibly do to sabotage the recording. We have manfully been sort of pushing her out of the way.
I was thinking about manfulness the other day because Jordan Peterson came up in the office and someone was describing him to one of my colleagues.
What office are you talking about?
The office at work.
What's your office at work?
It's an office in Whitechapel where I do my work.
I'm trying to get to what do you do?
Oh, what do I do? Oh, I'm still a journalist.
Okay.
But now I write about the health service, right?
Oh, okay.
I chronicle tense moments in the lives of NHS accountants.
Oh. Are you one of those people that, like, discovers that because of, you know, personal health budgets coming in, people can now use their own personal health budgets for things such as, like, yoga classes? So you can find, like, someone who uses their personal health budget on a yoga class and then put on the front page, NHS money goes to yoga class!
I'm one of the people who does the research that gets together all of the different, you know, here's what the money did get spent on, and we followed it up to look at this other study about the measurable difference in well-being. And here's the different things people spent the money on, and kind of overall it seemed to have these outputs, because there are measures for this kind of thing. But then that gets willfully misinterpreted by the Daily Mail. So sometimes you do kind of think...
So it is your fault, I'm glad to say. I'm glad you've admitted it.
Well, no, that's sort of like saying, can you blame the spring that sends fresh, clear water down the mountainside for the person who then turns some of that water into fizzy pop that melts people's teeth? No, you can't blame them.
Okay. Don't blame Ben Clover, he is but a sparkling stream of
Water. He's the babbling brook, he's not the evil bottle processing. He's not the fizzy plant.
We've got to finesse this. We've got to finesse this quote before it goes on your posters.
Don't blame Ben Clover. We'll just cut it. Say about Mitchum before I forget, right? It was my first patch on the paper.
What paper was it? Are you allowed to say?
It was the South London Press,
right?
But a specific Merton edition that literally no one else wanted to work on,
right?
And
right.
I was given it very quickly, pretty much as soon as I arrived. Kind of like, I don't want to do this anymore. But I met my then girlfriend here, she was my rival on the other newspaper.
Oh,
so like.
Our
eyes would meet over a crowded neighbourhood watch meeting.
That's something like out of a Tom Hanks rom-com.
I think that
was she
one,
Meg
but with
Ryan?
Michael Keaton. yeah, there was one like that about local paper. But yeah.
Oh, there actually is one like that.
Yeah, I think it's called something.
You should know. You should have watched it
I've
on repeat with your girlfriend.
It just looks.
Oh, it's like that.
It's not my. It was previous girlfriend. So if I was to make my current girlfriend. She hates being called that. That's the classic club comic joke. She hates being called that. And those are just the teachers. Anyway, to make her watch something that would be resonant about my previous relationship.
I do that all the time. I sit my partner down and I say, this was me and Michelle's movie. We used to watch this.
This thing. Yeah.
Christmas Eve, we used to watch this every year. Every year. For 6 years, we watched this. And now we're continuing the tradition. Isn't that nice?
Oh, my God. Have you ever tried to import an in-joke from an old relationship to a new one? I did it and it went disastrously wrong. It was a real learning moment.
What was the joke? What happened? Like, will it make sense?
Probably not, but like, I don't know. So you remember The Little Mermaid, the Disney film, right? Or my friend Tim, very silly man, my then girlfriend, Diana, she didn't have his number, so he would just show up as a random number. And sometimes when me and Diana were out, I'd text him and go like, do it, right? And then my girlfriend would then get a call from my mate Tim from an unknown number. So she'd answer it kind of like,
hello?
And what she'd hear is, no, Ariel, you must return under the sea where you belong. She's like, hello? Hello? And she's like, no, Ariel, you are not made to live on the land. You must return beneath the sea where you're from. It's like, who is this? And then you go, under the sea, under the sea. It's like, who is this? And then he'd hang up. Kind of, and it would just be a, like, you know, that sort of meaningless in-joke where... After a little while, she'd realise, like, after the third or fourth time. I'd only do it once every 6 months.
What was the relevance of The Little Mermaid?
There was no relevance of The Little Mermaid. The point was she got a call from an unknown
random.
Number, and it was completely random that suddenly she was being called by Sebastian the Crab from The Little Mermaid, and he'd sing a bit of the song and then hang up.
Right.
And it got to be a really nice in-joke. After a little while, after about, you know, 2 years, we didn't overdo it. It'd be like once every 6 months and it'd be at random. She'd get a phone call at random and go, oh, I wonder who
this
is.
Oh, it's Sebastian again.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I thought, about 4 months into the next relationship, I thought, well, I'll get Tim to do it. But she was a bit freaked out at this kind of call at random. I was quite upset. And I was like, this was a terrible mistake. Kind of both conceptually and in practice. Because you shouldn't try and import stuff from a previous relationship apart from the stuff you can't avoid.
I'll tell you a story of a practical joke / nice surprise that I tried to pull on a girlfriend. Not quite the same thing. It wasn't an in-joke from another relationship, but it was ill-conceived. The plan was that I was going to have to stay at this gig. I wasn't going to be in that night to see my then girlfriend. So gig was cancelled. So on the way back home, I sort of gave her a call. I thought, this is going to be a nice surprise. I'll get to spend the evening with her. But I'll give her a call just to, like, make her not expect me. And I said, oh, yeah, hi, just checking in. Still at the gig, you know, waiting to go on, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, about 30 seconds later, I was coming in through the door. And she was fucking terrified. Fucking terrified. She got a phone call from her boyfriend saying, oh, it's still at the gig. And
Who
then someone just came in
this?
Through the door.
Oh, that is, it's one of those things that with even 2 seconds retrospect, you're like, oh, I can see exactly how this is a terrible. And also, we're glad we live in Britain, because in America, that story would have ended with, and then she shot me in the guts.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, practically, because it's April Fool's Day has just passed. And I remember being told about April Fool's Day by my dad, because he did, I can't remember what he did, but I thought, oh, okay, so I should do one of these. And I didn't know what to do. So I just, like, I got some, he made, like, a cheese and garlic salad. Mum had died by that point. And I thought, oh, I'll just pour some Ribena in it. That would be, like, a prank. And then later on he came up and was like, well, did you pour Ribena in my salad? And I was like, yeah, for April Fool's. And he's like, yeah, it's supposed to be funny. That's just... that's just shit. You know,
yeah, it's not also... Like, it's also not... I thought April Fool's was trying to convince people of a thing.
I think, yeah, deception is the thing rather than just sabotage.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't be like, oh, I've just cut your face.
No, yeah.
Like, you know, it can't just be just a meaninglessly destructive...
You can't just, like, tip over someone's chips. April Fool's!
That's just bullying, isn't it? Yeah. It's kind of... Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's no got to be like, really. World War III has broken out! Run!
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of thing. Those are kind of harmless japes.
We get sent lots of press releases, rather, about this, some like phobia coach, and the PR company is always trying to get people to do articles on him, kind of. And the one that came through the other week was, you know, for lots of people, April Fool's is a harmless time of merriment and pranks, but for lots of phobics, it's a terrifying time where they're brought face to face with what they think is a deadly snake. But in fact, it's just a rubber snake that's been bought from her. And Dr. Matt is available to do a whole feature for this on you if you want. We really want to get Dr. Matt out there. Mm. Please put Dr. Matt, please. We're paid by the amount of times we can get Dr. Matt into print or on air. Please feature Dr. Matt. He'll say almost anything you want, if you want. Please. Please.
So how was it covering Mitchum as an area?
Oh man, yeah. It's not the thing that really sickened me about Mitchum, because I got off at Tooting Station and walked down. And the last time I was at Tooting Station, I know people are going to be like, Ben, when were you last at Tooting Station? The last time I was at Tooting Station was to meet the Mitchum leather trousers man, right? Because there was this guy, he got in touch, and he had this lovely, he was from the deep south of America, and he had this like lovely kind of deep southern accent. And he'd invented this kind of form of leather trouser, and he had this whole like ethos behind it. But the idea was that these leather trousers weren't like normal trousers or other leather trousers. They were sort of around the groin. They had this sort of kind of cricket box kind of circular shape. So yeah, they looked very strange, but it was a sort of And the idea was
not see through.
No, all I think it was a sort of plasticky material on the sort of groin bit.
Okay.
And then, apart from that, conventional
trousers. Oh, is it to let your groin breathe?
That was it. That was the thing. He's like, and it was, he gave me the whole rationale for it. And it was like, so, and he got me to try on a pair. Mm. But I didn't have much time, so I only got to meet him at Tooting Station.
You didn't have enough time for your balls to sweat or not sweat.
But I had to put on these trousers. I had to meet him at Tooting Station on the platform, put on these trousers, get him to take a picture of me, because it was like, again, no photographer. And write about it, and then write the articles. It was deadline morning. But like, he had this whole ethos about. He said the kind of, it's not natural for men to wear trousers, Ben. It's not natural. You're all cooped up in there. You know, you can't breathe free. You can't swing free as your desire. He had this sort of like preachery sort of tone. Like, yeah, and then there's an over for 2,000 years, Ben. Women have had the sensuous advantage. They had the sensuous advantage because men. You know, look at ancient Rome. Look at the Greeks. They wore togas. They wore togas and they hang free and they felt free and they fought free. But at some point, men became women wore trousers because they've gotten. Not the same level of external genitalia, Ben. Ah, oh, I'm going to start a revolution, Ben. He was a real...
It like, sounds like it.
He was a real believer in it. And like, lots of time, we'd write stories and nothing would happen. It felt a bit like howling into the void. I wrote the story about him and it got picked up by the Daily Star. He had a picture of him like holding his mental trousers. He's a really sweet guy. And he rang up to go, I just want to thank you, Ben, But Daily Star, which I understand is quite a classy publication, has taken me up on my offer, and soon the leather trousers groin revolution is going to start and men will once again feel free. I was like, oh, that was sweet.
Because that was a good deed for the day.
It was nice. It was nice. And like the thing about Mitch, someone else told me this. I can't remember what this guy invented, but like I met a surprising number of inventors from Mitcham, and this bloke had a theory about it. He went, well, the thing about Mitcham is... it's the second cheapest area for housing in London.
Yep.
Right. So lots of people move here for a second chance. You know, so it's loads of... So this guy had been like some quite senior scientist at some engineering company or something, but everything had gone wrong. And so he'd moved back to the cheapest place he could find. And he was, I don't know, he'd made shoes that were also vacuum cleaners or something. But like, he was going to... That was where he was like basing himself for his second run at... So it was sort of sweet to think that, like, oh, it was an area that wasn't just, you know, crackheads. There were also people who were kind of like, yeah, things went wrong, but now I've got a plan.
Yeah, that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, when I was 22, I decided time for a second chance. Things had gone very, very badly, very quickly for me, as it turned out. So, yeah, time to retreat to Mitcham.
Yeah, and it's got Figs Marsh. It's, I mean, which today was like an actual marsh.
You also, in your show, mentioned that you covered like a terrorist sort of warlord.
Oh, yeah, Zardad.
Zardad.
Zardad. Fayez Ali Zardad, he was called. And he was in the papers again, maybe about a year ago. I think, I can't remember why. And he's still in Belmarsh, which is where they put, I think, the terror prisoners. But yeah, he was like, he controlled an area of Kandahar. And he had like in Afghanistan, and he was a warlord. Basically, John Simpson got some tip off that he was there and went and doorstepped him. Surely, I think, you know, having been tipped off by the security service, who then arrested him, put him on trial for terror stuff, and jailed him. But I had to do the follow up, the kind of shitty local newspaper follow up. I had to go down his little cul-de-sac just behind the shopping centre, and ask the neighbours, "Did you have any idea that your neighbour was a warlord?" And one of them went, "Well, his garden was never very tidy." And you're like, so if you are a fugitive warlord trying to...
tidy up the garden.
Yeah, keep it neat.
Yeah.
Otherwise, someone will grass you up to, like, The Hague.
So, it's Mitcham's pretty much mad inventors, murderers and warlords.
There's a lot of domestic abuse as well.
Oh, don't forget that.
No. I mean, yeah, because I used to go to the magistrates' court every Tuesday just to see what's happening. So it means, like, when I walk through any of Merton, really, you get to know where all of the... you kind of go, oh, Acacia Avenue. That's where that guy burnt down all of the sheds because he was jealous of their sheds, so he burnt down everyone else's shed. Or I can't remember if that was Acacia Avenue, but like, you'd look at the listings of the magistrates' court and sometimes you'd be like, well, that's a boring crime, but an interesting name. Come on, the guy's called Elvis. Like, Elvis has left the building in a prison van. You know, that'd be fun. But there was one, it was a really posh kid in Wimbledon. And I remember thinking, like, the name Curzon, that's like a familiar name. And like the road he was on was really posh. And he'd been done for, like, fraud. What happened is he'd got sent, this is like this posh 19-year-old, had been sent a cheque in error meant for his next-door neighbour. And it had his next-door neighbour's name on it. She was this old lady and her annuity had matured. And it was a cheque for £119,000.
Wow.
So he crossed her name out on the cheque, wrote his own name, took it to the bank.
And yeah. They were like,
come back in a week and we'll tell you if it's cleared. You know, standard cheque clearing procedure. Mm-hmm. Came back in a week, was arrested, pleaded guilty. And I was like, you're going to go down, posh boy, and I'm going to sell the story to the Telegraph and I'm going to make 400 quid selling the story to the Telegraph. But they found a way to not jail him. Because it was like his first offence. I was like, drat.
Because he had affluenza.
Well, this is... I'll get to that, right? And then I'm in magistrates court again a year later. The same kid is up again for like leaving the scene of an accident in his car, right? Which is a serious offence and can't help but trigger the suspended sentence he's already got for the cheque fraud. And no other reporters are in court. And I'm like, when this guy gets sent down, I'm going to sell it to the Telegraph for 400 quid. I'm going to make a It's going to be great, right? So I go along to the Crown Court where he's going to be sentenced, right? I'm personally invested in this kid going to jail, this posh boy. And then by the time his defence barrister has sat down, I'm practically in tears going, this poor boy never stood a chance. You know, kind of, his system was rigged against him. Like, he's got some kind of ill-defined mental condition that has really held him back. And
oh, really? So you ended up sympathising?
The barrister was so fucking good at his job that I ended up thinking, if anyone's the monster here, it's society. You know, this boy who was the fourth in line to the viceroydom of India. They were like the Curzons who had been in charge of the Raj for two generations or something. He had no chance in our justice system. I remember seeing that bloke's barrister on the other side of the train tracks, and I caught his eye, and he just like winked, kind of like, it's like, yeah, you earned your money there, because he didn't go down again, you know. To be honest, it probably wouldn't have done anyone any good if he had gone to prison, but like, still, you can't have one rule for posh people and one rule for...
No, you can't.
No, think about it, you can't. You shouldn't.
The thing about that affluenza is it's the more...
Poor people never get it. For an infectious disease, yeah. It doesn't travel, does it? Kind of...
No, I mean, the thing is, it's a very stupid name. Is it fair, to criticize... Who coined that name? Was it a defence attorney?
Someone got a book out of it, and I think it might have been a psychiatrist... Orcologist.
Okay, so it wasn't like, you know, the papers making a sort of making a mockery of it and saying, oh, what's he got? Affluenza, and that caught on.
I think it was some...
Genuinely argued to be a thing.
I think probably if you're like a successful psychologist / psychiatrist, you might look down slightly on the one of your colleagues who makes fuckloads of money on a sort of theory-ish book that takes your own particular area of expertise and stretches it way beyond what you've got evidence for, gives it a catchy name, and suddenly makes millions of quid, doing book tours and selling your book.
Is that's what's happened?
I think so. I could be wrong.
But there's a bloke who's dining out on affluenza.
There's a bloke who probably made millions of quid and got like in all the broadsheets, basically thing kind of going, isn't it weird how those people are rich but aren't happy? You know, which...
My understanding of it was that it was just, if you're being, you know, super cynical about it, it's just like a get-out-of-jail-free card for rich people. That the idea is that they're so rich that they don't have, they haven't had as much of a chance to feel as connected to the lives of ordinary people and ordinary morality and consequences for their actions because they've been so coddled and protected from all that, and that has left them with a lack of responsibility and moral compass. Which
spoilt bastard syndrome.
Spoilt bastard syndrome. If it wasn't called affluenza, and if there wasn't some dude who was cynically using that term to make loads of money or whatever, if it was just argued that, like any other extenuating circumstance to consider, is that this rich guy has had this upbringing and that may have affected it in a way that isn't strictly his fault, and so don't let him off, but take it into consideration like you would any other extenuating circumstance, I can kind of see that being fair enough. Except that there would have to be, you know, extenuating circumstances applied as liberally to those who weren't rich bastards.
Perhaps more liberally, because you could say this person's had every advantage and every more opportunity to avail themselves of moral education to not do that kind of thing. But I think affluenza might
but I don't
be...
there's people who are so super rich that they're literally, their parents have just ruined them as people.
There's a thing about like the super rich, a lot of them will think that doors just open, they've never actually opened the door, that whenever you're walking towards a door, there's someone whose job it is
to open
it. My mate's a nurse in one of the private wings of a London teaching hospital, and she said the thing with your mega rich kind of Gulf state royal families is they're very messy. She said in that they're just if I finished my chocolate bar, I will just drop it on the floor because there's almost always someone around whose job it is to sort that out. So you'd be sort of almost childlikely helpless in some situations if you're removed from that. But just on the Ethel Ensign thing for a second, I don't think that was the one used as a sort of excuse for criminal behaviour. I think Ethel Ensign was just like a term for the general malaise for people who really don't have a lot of problems.
Oh, I thought affluenza was being applied just... My understanding of affluenza before this conversation was that it was just that. That some rich kids don't have as much of a moral compass or sense of responsibility as they might because they've been so spoiled. But, I mean, that was literally from reading, like, a couple of articles or whatever. So you're probably... It sounds like you know more about it than me.
About, like, the French department stores at, like, the turn of the 20th century. Basically, loads of posh Parisian women were getting done for shoplifting. And that in reaction to that, the mental condition of kleptomania essentially had to be created because, you know, they'd been punishing the poor for theft for hundreds of years, but suddenly it's a real problem if like very important rich people's wives and daughters are getting done for shoplifting the whole time. So you kind of, it's around the same time you kind of go, hey, this guy in Vienna's got this crazy idea, but actually it's not a criminal condition, it's a mental one. Kleptomania, let him off.
Yeah, but I'm going to continue playing devil's advocate here. If there is a poor person stealing a loaf of bread, say, okay, just to be super cliched about it.
That's the classic. Yeah.
The classic stealing loaf of bread from Tesco Metro, sorry, which shut down in Mitcham.
No way.
You know what? Tesco was repelled by Mitcham.
Wow.
You know what else was repelled? McDonald's.
McDonald's shut down here.
You know what they both became? Pound shops. Wow. Both of them.
I used to know the manager in there.
I feel quite proud of that.
I know, you're sort of... This is... if when capitalism does end, right, eventually it will hit some kind of wall. And maybe that wall is Mitcham.
Yeah.
Kind of... That's the very furthest that the pendulum swings.
It's the beginning of a new epoch.
And then, you know, soon those stores will be out of Tooting. And then out of Streatham. And then it will kind of spread from... But kind of like you're at the very... impact point of like, no, and now it swings back.
Let's hope so. Well, just that wave will ripple outwards into London and everything will be pound shops.
Gosh.
That's the world I want to live in. Everything costs a pound and is cheaply made.
And then it'll be like...
Falls apart.
Rather than saying like the pound has fallen or risen against the dollar or the euro, you'd be like, this collection of this 5-pack of plastic ducks has fallen or risen against the pound. Or you're kind of like, it must be very tight to... Yeah, actually, once one of the things in Mitcham, there was we never found out who it was, but there was a guy in sort of night vision glasses who was hunting swans at night with an air rifle in the pond, and they never caught him.
Still at large,
unless they cracked the case after 2008, and I didn't know about
that's
it.
Possible.
Probably it didn't happen.
I would imagine it would make the national press if it had happened.
I don't know. I think people mistreat wildfowl all the time, and it goes under the radar. Oh man! Because we were talking about sending death threats earlier. You don't need any more context than that recording.
We're just talking about how many death threats we've been sending recently.
Yeah, and how wicked they were. It got quite competitive. Mm. There was this case that was from round here. It was more your Figs Marsh end of Mitcham. Right, and it was this guy who'd been sending analog, not death threats, but pictures of himself wearing a nappy and wanking in a motorbike helmet so people couldn't see who it was.
Cunning.
And he sent that to like hundreds of people. That's a knock at the door.
Oh, I'm so sorry. One sec.
No, it's...
One second.
I hope it's not the nappy man, because that would be... You. It's just a package.
You've been vamping.
I've been continuing to explain about... I was saying I was hoping the knock at the door wasn't the nappy man, because if you just need to say his name once and he appears instantly at the door, and that'd be even more terrifying than it was. Yeah, he'd send these pictures and other weird images to like dozens and dozens and dozens, like maybe even hundreds of people. And I'm not quite sure how they tracked him down, but they did eventually track him down, and I wrote about his court case. And then loads more people got in touch saying, oh, he's also sent this stuff to me. And people, I'd go around to people's houses and they'd lay out like dozens of these weird letters or pictures of him, like out on the kitchen floor, and saying, like, I thought I was the only one.
Oh,
and
my
he sent them to like library staff, like the receptionist in his like GP surgery, all of the GPs at the GP surgery, kind of all of the people in the shops, like all of his neighbours, kind of people at the other end of the borough when he had to go up there for some reason. And like, and it was largely, I mean, 2005 wasn't pre-internet, but it was before it was as pervasive as it is now. And it's just weird to think of like all of these people, and like the reactions must have been very different. Like, some people must have been, it might even have been a joke, like, well, that is weird. You know, probably in our house, if we've got it, we'd be like, well, we've got the nappy man's here again. You know, it might even become something that you get to talk about with the postman, kind of going, I think it might be the nappy man for you, mate, with this handwriting. And other people, it was probably crushing. I remember this one woman like being in tears about it. So I went to the sentencing at Kingston Crown Court and was like, right, I'm going to get a picture of this guy coming out of court, because again, I didn't, the photographer wasn't fucking there because I was the only person who worked on this newspaper. We could rarely get a photographer,
right?
And this bloke came out and I thought he was like classic loner widow, but he had like four or five sons in biker gear with him, and I was like, I'm not going to get beaten to death by the nappy man and his gang.
They're all wearing biker helmets.
Well, they were wearing biker gear.
Tribute.
I think they were just bikers.
In solidarity.
I think that was just how they dressed.
Oh, okay.
But his sons had come with him.
I was almost touched then by that story. I thought, these four sons, they've stood up for their dad's right to wank in a nappy, take photos and send them to strangers. And they've shown solidarity by dressing up in his favourite wanking gear.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe they were also wearing nappies underneath. But, like, in a way, he sort of invented the unsolicited, disturbing sexual picture, which now is a
play. Oh, I'd imagine it was going on a long time before that.
I guess, but kind of... But no, he would have been at the forefront of... You know, he must have had access to a cheap printer.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to admire the scale of it.
Well, it was like a sort of... The amount of work that went into it was, you could have run a small business. You know, that appeared to be the scale of it. And it was all just emanating from this.
I wonder what he was getting out of it. Just knowing. Because was he kind of outside to see the reaction? If that were me, I'd want to see.
I think it was.
People opening it.
I think it was.
And having a reaction. Maybe film it for later.
Maybe, yeah. I don't. Because in those days, filming it would involve a camcorder and it would have been a bit difficult. But I think it might have been I'm no criminal psychologist, but my girlfriend knows about this kind of thing. And she reckoned maybe it would have been a kind of a power thing in that you kind of go, you may think you're better than me,
but look
hoity-toity
at me.
Hoity-toity receptionist, yes. But soon you'll be getting a picture of a certain, like, wanking baby kind of... It was grim.
And then next time he saw them... Presumably he'd sort of know they'd got it.
He would know and maybe be looking for some trace of... This has now become like one of those true crime podcasts, but you don't want this to become your niche. It's like, not murders, wanking crimes.
Wanking crimes.
I was talking to another actor about this the other day and she went... Because I was seeing lots of those like murderist podcasts. She'd been to one of the live shows and said it's a very female audience. And she went, I think it's because women can have more of a public interest in serial killers than men because...
They're the victims.
Yeah, because it doesn't look as creepy. Like, if you or I kind of went, oh, I'm really into learning about serial killers, and people would be like,
oh, but I am.
Are you now?
I am, though. And I don't mind who knows it. And you know who my favourite one is? Bundy. Yeah? Yeah?
I'm just going to say, I've enabled location data on my phone, so...
Bundy's my favourite one. The one who killed just women. I mean, that is... And he was a horrible man. But just in terms of, you know, the story, the narrative, hard to beat.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the making a murderer, when we're talking about
everyone
that.
Everyone says Dharma. Right? As though Dharma's just like the rock star of the group. Bundy. Check him out.
Is this like the hipster choice for serial killers? It's kind of like
Dharma.
Everyone says they prefer the Rolling Stones, but actually, I think the Kinks were a better band.
Yeah, well, exactly. And there's sort of a kind of socio-political thing because he killed men, Dharma. Oh, yeah, I mean, you've got to like the one that kills the men because of feminism. That's what it is. Bloody feminism.
Absolutely.
It's ruined yet another discussion.
Shut it down. Shut it down. Right, I'm off.
Ben Clover, you're a new daddy.
Well, a year and a half now.
A year and a half. Okay, I'm not that new. Let's move on.
Yeah. No, I'm happy to never talk about it ever. It would be my private shame. Yeah.
How's it going? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's wicked.
Any regrets?
Some. Yeah. There's a bit I was coming back from taking my daughter to see her great-grandmother in a care home, and Gran wasn't in a good way. And I'd forgotten to bring... I only brought half as much medicine for the baby as I should have done. So she was really cross, and I was walking back through the outskirts of Guildford on this like horribly biting cold day, and I realised there's very little I could do to ameliorate the baby's suffering, and she was doing that kind of new whole notes, kind of like metal, but kind of but made to really, I mean, like evolved over tens of thousands of years to particularly hurt my ears.
Yes,
I'm thinking like maybe walking back over this motorway bridge, kind of going, should I kill myself and the baby, or just myself? Just myself. And then you kind of think, oh, do you know what? If there'd been a sort of testing place that I'd walk past, kind of get just to double check this is my baby, because there's a small chance it's not my problem at this point.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm pretty sure it's my baby, but kind of, no, I'm 100% sure. But kind of, but I was so desperate for an out at that point, and I also feeling so guilty that I'd fucked up and
had much
medicine as I should have done. It was only like cold medicine or something. It wasn't like she was in no danger, but it was a very uncomfortable, but yeah, broadly it's amazing.
I'm convinced.
Yeah.
Is it as tough as everyone whinges about? Because there's a part of me that thinks I could handle it. I reckon they're exaggerating.
They are, but it is really bad.
Why though?
When it's really bad, it's
bad about it? There's a baby. Give it what it wants. It shuts up. Sometimes you have to get up in the middle of the night. It's all right.
No, it's when it is.
People have been doing it for ages, Ben.
I know, but that was when life was awful and they had very little expectation that life should be in any way good at all.
I see. So the standards are higher now.
So now, kind of, you know, because what was that?
Oh, it's because you're worried about giving her the best shot in life and all that.
Yeah, there's lots of guilt and worries.
I hadn't thought about that.
But also just like, you know, when it's really bad, it is really bad. Like kind of 4 days of like, you realise how important sleep is. And kind of, and if you've got like 4 days in a row of it's really bad. Like so for example, like I would, there'd be a time when she'd only go to sleep when she'd been walked around in a sling. And she wouldn't do that for like 3 hours or something. So I'd have to put her in a sling at 3 a.m, work the next day, that kind of thing. But I had to walk around the flat with her in a sling while she, you know, really does lasting damage to your hearing. And you just cover so much. I must have walked like all the way from Elephant to Croydon and back just round the flat, pacing like some mentally ill tiger in a zoo. I'm thinking, please go to sleep, kind of, please, like reasoning with this creature that was incapable of understanding how important it was that you were alive enough the next day to be able to do the spreadsheets you needed to do. But apart from that, it's wicked. Yeah, apart from sometimes feeling like
my sleep's already bad though, so I reckon that's fine.
Well, I can always, if I've learned one thing, it's that everything can get worse.
Okay,
so
that's what having a child has taught you.
Yeah, but also there's lovely highs as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like let's talk about some of those.
It's lame to kind of go, my daughter mispronounces some words, and it is adorable. You know, she'll say nook, right, when she wants milk. Nook, Isn't that sweet? She'll say Gumball.
So they talk. They talk at that age, yeah. A year and a half.
One and a half, she's got some words on her. I mean, they're mangled shit words.
Right.
So Nook isn't milk, but we understand.
Oh, I thought they were more or less babbling idiots until about three or four.
No,
I don't know anything about babies.
Tom Holmes has got a kid who's about a year older than mine. And he said the other day, like, oh, my son just said, just a minute to me. I was like, wow, that is advanced. He's like, he doesn't know what it means. He's just parroted a phrase that we say to him all the time. And if I can make her understand one thing, it's the concept of, like, the fact that I'm doing these two other important things before I give you your Nook doesn't mean you're never, ever getting... It doesn't mean I've decided to stop nourishing you.
Yes.
Just give me a minute and I will attend to your very real concerns.
Yeah, because that's the thing about being a baby is you're not sure yet
whether
the suffering that you're currently going through is ever going to end.
Yeah, but that might be the permanent state of the world.
It's an existentially terrifying time.
Yeah, and she's only got like a year's worth of experience knowing that we've not abandoned her or, you know, left her to be mauled by dogs. and that we won't let that happen. But kind of from her point of view, it's like, well, I mean, like, and when have we earned enough trust that she'll be like, nah, I reckon this will be fine. Probably most of the time. She's learning. She's like a little learning beast. Yeah.
So did you, might be an indelicate question, but I don't mean it to be. Did you sort of do a lot of planning? Was it a surprise?
No, we were working on it. I had a whole thing about, at one point I had to go to the assisted conception unit, which was always a bit of a blow, because you always assume that, like, I've always thought I'm pretty fertile. Mm. And at one point we had to go to the assisted conception unit, and I did used to do a bit about the humiliating process of submitting your semen
for analysis.
I kind of like, you know, it's only that context. There's only two contexts where medical professionals will analyse your semen, and the other one is some kind of horrible sex crime analysis. and I was doing this bit once about going to guys' hospital and the horrendously low quality of the porn they had there to help you out. I was talking about it, and there's this couple kind of talking to one another. Well, I was like, oh, you familiar with this experience? Because I realise when you're talking about fertility issues, like, it can be quite upsetting for some people. Some people might be like, well, we can't, you know, we've got friends going through that kind of thing at the moment. And I said, oh, you know, it was just like an open mic gig somewhere. And it was the lady said, no, I work in that lab. I work in the guy's assisted conception unit. And I'm like, wow. Since, like,
so he did it.
I know it was late.
He tested your cum.
She may well have handled my... And it's the least jizz. Laddie way I've ever got to say to a stranger, so you may have handled my jizz. it wasn't laddie at all. It was like, yeah, you're someone who God doesn't want to breed, or at least not easily.
I once was in Boots, and I saw a little pamphlet that said, if you want to, we'll test your piss for chlamydia in here. So if you want to, like, just collect a little thing from the thing. Sorry, damn fucking right I am. I want to walk into Boots with a vial of my piss and give it to the cashier, and she has to take it from me. How, like, I didn't know this experience was available. It was great. I went home. I had a little whittle, went back out, and then...
just, here it is.
Here it is, take it.
Yeah.
Take it from me.
You have to.
It's your job.
About this experience was horrible when I did it. Like, she
didn't even try and hide her disgust,
yeah,
to her credit.
Yeah, and she's not paid enough to hide it. Like,
no.
Because I think the same thing, I think she decided to enjoy it, the receptionist there, because, like, I came out of the lift, walked down the corridor, went like, oh, hi, my name's Ben Clover, I'm here for the 9:30. And she just looked at me, it was like, for the wanking appointment, you're going to make me say it. It was like 9:30 is like the least sexy time of the day, you know, to do
is
that.
Is there ever a sexy time to go and wank in a room?
Well, I mean, I don't know, but it felt like the least sexy time to do it.
Do you think if you get like a 9:30 appointment, you get a roll in there, hey, sugar, I'm here to... make a deposit.
She said,
and she's like, oh, let me show you through. There's lounge jazz music playing.
I didn't know what I expected, but I didn't expect the room to be quite as grim as it was. Because they have a special room for it, right? And they show you into the room. And outside they have this like light and a sign that says, red light will activate when room is in use. You know, just for anyone... Because anyone being shown down that corridor, she must have to show dozens of men down that corridor into that room each day. And people must look, like her colleagues must be like, oh yeah, he's in for the... So I go in there and I think, I'm going to turn the light off. This feels weird. It feels weird to do this in a hospital. Like I turn the light off and the walls are so thin that I can hear like the secretaries next door kind of chatting and stuff. So I turn the light off and instantly they all stop talking straight away. It's like, what do you... Can you hear everything? If I turn the lights off in there as well, do they all have to be quiet while it's being done? And also, they had a giant like floor to ceiling mirror on the wall.
Right.
I was like, no one needs a mirror. Not in that. No one. Who is kind of like, unless I'm looking in my own eyes, going, you're a winner. And like, porn was really... I don't know much about porn, but I know what I like, and this was really...
It was just imagery, well, no video
there
content.
Was actually... It turned out later there was video equipment, but there was a...
You had to request it,
magazines.
Did you?
I just looked in the wrong drawer.
Oh, I see.
But weirdly, all the magazines had little sticks on them saying, property of Guy's Hospital fees will be prosecuted. Like, no one's going to steal this. But who... It was a horrible experience.
There are people for whom that would be quite the turn on.
Nappy man, maybe.
Yeah.
Guy's Hospital porn.
How does it fit in with gigging? Have you taken any kind of sabbatical?
I should have
or
done.
Or paternity leave? It doesn't seem like you have.
No, I try and... Basically, I'm lucky enough that I live near enough work that I can go into work, come home, put the baby to bed. She goes to bed at 7. Kind of that takes about half an hour, and then broadly, you can.
It takes half an hour to put her to bed.
Yeah, sometimes more. But
because when I picture picking up a baby, and then putting her in a cot, and then putting a blanket over her, it doesn't take half an hour.
No, it was bath time.
Bedtime involves bedtime.
Yeah,
bedtime
means bedtime. Let's not fuck around.
So bedtime means bath time also.
But yeah, that's the ritual that we have.
I wasn't aware
of
that.
To sing our little songs, she has to.
Oh, you got to wash them, of course.
Got to wash them. They're filthy creatures. And then you have to read a book while you put it to bed. You have to wait for the nighttime sheep to finish its unearthly glowing. There's various rituals.
At what point does the bedtime story kick in?
At
what point are they like?
I don't know. It's not yet
receptive enough.
Like another year, she loves to look at books, and we kind of read what I need to. You really need to turn the books over quite frequently, otherwise it gets hugely dull.
I would imagine though that she's probably of the age where she doesn't really give a flip about the stories, the narratives.
No, not at all. No.
She wants to just hear your lovely, calming voice. That she's kind of. I mean, it's a lovely voice anyway, as I've already said. But she's also biologically keyed in.
I think
to
so,
find it
yeah.
very comforting.
Yeah.
So you could say whatever that you like. That's what
I know,
I'm saying.
I do.
Yeah.
But like, she's
you should take advantage of that.
I did.
Slip in some subconscious messages.
Yeah, I've informed her about who secretly runs the world. That kind of thing. You're never too young to know that stuff. I've noticed with lots of dads is they'll go like, oh my god, if anyone ever came for my family, it's sort of like the punching a Nazi thing. People like to kind of show off.
Yeah.
Because there's no better. You could make a really good clip, I think, of all of the times when someone threatens The Rock's family in a film, and like, he's pretty feisty beforehand, but he becomes like super feisty afterwards.
Jesus Christ.
And you're licensed for any elaborate, outlandish act of violence, which is really what everyone's there to see.
Sure.
As long as the villains have, like, threatened the kid in some way.
What I love about those revenge movies is every single one of them will have a token character that for about 30 seconds will represent the moral argument against vengeance. So we're all here to see the vengeance.
We're
absolutely
here to see someone get punched right through the throat. Like
yes,
in
please.
One side, out
yes.
the other side.
Repeatedly, and over and over again,
like a propeller.
From a lot of different angles, please. But because I think they must have to in order to argue that no, our film has subtle, complex themes and it engages with vigilante justice on a very deep level. and it's not just about guts being thrown across the room. So they will have, it's usually a woman too, like a policewoman.
Yeah.
Or say like, it's not going to bring him back, Max. I don't know why she's got such a deep voice. But yeah.
She,
yeah. She'll be like, your family's never going to return. Violence isn't the end. But then after that, it will seem like, oh yeah, okay, the film's really grappling with these themes. But then like 5 seconds later, he'll be back running over somebody with a lawnmower or something.
I reckon there's a specialist role in Hollywood. Because you know punch-up on Hollywood scripts, where you get someone will improve a script. And there's probably an agency that specializes in fig leaf punch-up. You're going to go, we've got some cracking violence in this film. But like, really, if we're not going to get called exploitative, we'll have to get some fig leaf punch-up in. So, and then someone will just write that bit of dialogue you extemporise.
Of course, it's got to be the same person because the lines are always the same.
Yeah, so it's probably a machine does it now.
So you go out there, you kill all the bad guys, then what? You're going to live with it for the rest of your life.
I watched the Watchmen film the other day. And who watches those who watch the Watchmen film? But the Watchmen film was dreadful, right? And I didn't really like the book. But anyway, although I like some of his other stuff. But there's this bit where one of the retired...
Zack Snyder's other stuff, you mean?
No. Some of Alan Moore's other stuff. Sorry. Being very slow. Because I'm a dad. Yeah, the bit where the retired owl man and the semi-retired attractive woman, there's a bit where they beat the shit out of some muggers.
Yeah, right? And then they bang each other.
Well, no, because I think originally they were going to be turned on by violence and bang one another, but I think Fig Leaf Punch-Up must have gone, we can't make the link between sex and violence that clear.
Mm.
So in fact, they bang each other after saving a load of people from a fire.
Yes,
but
I
clearly,
remember that. So in the comics, it was beating up a bunch of muggers.
So at least they wore their violence erection more clearly on their sleeve in the comic. But I just thought, oh, that's nice. Because in 300, they didn't even really bother disguising it. Just like, these guys look like a gang of Asia Minor perverts. Cut their heads off, like really inventively, but really, because also, yeah, just in that scene where they really go to town on those muggers, right? The people who deserve the bravery awards are like muggers 5 through 7, you know, who've obviously been like, let's mug this couple,
yeah,
but muggers 1 through 4. That clearly you're up against very skilled opponents. They're a bit rusty, but they're still hugely experienced. And they're like, you know, they've done something where they, you know, that bit in your wrist, they've pulled that out and garrotted one of the other ones or something. It's kind of like, but muggers 5 through 7 are still like, no, we can turn this round. You're like, you know, at that point, back off and get easier prey.
Run away.
That's the thing, is like, so many of those ones are kind of like, oh, they picked the wrong guy.
Mm.
You know, it's always them picking the wrong guy. Sometimes that's in the tagline, they picked the wrong guy.
And no, they picked the wrong guy and then persevered.
And
that's the problem.
Yeah. Is there any point you'd be like, just once, just to even it out, like, someone was like, they picked the right guy. But like, if they pick me, they pick the right guy.
Your perspective on the world or anything in particular changed since you've had a babby? Has it opened up your something?
I'm a lot happier, I think.
Oh.
And that's nice.
That's nice.
Because there's a lot more.
It is nice.
There's a lot more joy about.
Mm.
But there's a bit more worry. I mean, I was my girlfriend's always right about things and I'm always wrong. But like, I thought we shouldn't try and get shared ownership on a flat because the bubble's about to burst. And she was right. It wasn't.
Right.
She was right. And I was like, I genuinely thought we shouldn't have a kid because the world will get really much worse in the next 35 years. And I still think that's the case. And I still think maybe... I mean, but I think I'd over-imbibed on things like the road and, you know, projections of environmental degradation and demographics, which, you know, is science and I think definitely will happen. But at my most dramatic, I'd be like, at some point, the road's going to happen and we'll be, as older parents in our mid-50s, we won't be strong enough to protect you from cannibals as we flee the shattered ruins of London and try and make a life for ourselves in some dell in Kent, like fending off local cannibals. I don't have the survival skills. I never have had, and I can't be bothered to develop them.
Well, now's the time to start.
But then I think about, like, I might try and do a show about this called, like, Lazy Survivalist, because I do think probably things will go horribly wrong, and I should become, like, one of those American nutters who actually stocks up a bunker in Wales.
Doomsday prepper.
One of those preppers.
Mm.
But I can't be bothered. I can't be bothered. And, like, I hate camping, and I hate tinned food. And, like, so it makes me think, actually, I wouldn't want to live in a post-civilisation world anyway, so I'm not going to prepare for a post-civilisation world.
I'll let the cannibals come and get you.
Yeah, and I'll just try and enjoy as much of the good times as possible.
You'd be one of those characters in episode one of the zombie drama who's running away, oh my god, and then gets eaten alive to demonstrate the horrors of this new world to the main characters.
I think I'd be one of those ones who foolishly still believed a little too much in our shared humanity.
Mm.
I'd be like, of course I'll let you in, survivors, of course. Like, but shut the door. Oh, you're going to... you're going to steal my medicine, leave the door open, having shot me in both legs, and knowing in fact that it buys a bit of time for you to escape more, but the zombies will come in and eat us before giving you an extra 10 minutes.
Well, those characters are important. So, Ben Clover, we've come to the end of the show. You need to go and do baby stuff.
Yeah, I'll deliver pudding to some resentful women. I wish that was as fun as it. I wish that was innuendo, but it's not.
Thank you very much for coming. It's been great. You came even though your train was cancelled, it was raining. So you get top grade for effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Top grade for effort is always... can't help but make you wonder about the other grades. Because I really rather fancy myself as a sort of shiftless genius who's 0 for effort, 10 for content. But thank you. The fact that you think I tried...
That sounded very, very, very mean. That happens to me a lot. My moments of sincere praise end up being devastating.
It can really put you off sincerity, can't it? Yeah. No, thank you for having me. It was lots of fun.
Thanks for coming. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to Series 3, Episode 4 of Ollie Bettisworth's downloadable weekly podcast programme with my guest Ben Clover and additional music from Kevin MacLeod. As always, if you've enjoyed the show, do something for me, guys, in return. Go onto the site, review it, rate it, send me praise, send me gifts, suck on my sweet balls, give me a foot massage, something. Something, guys, in return. You know. No episode next week, as I said. So see you in 2 weeks. Bye.